This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Welcome back. You're listening to The Morning Run, 7:36, Monday, the 27th of June. I'm Wong Shaoning, together with Philip C. And as usual, in about 30 minutes after the 8 a.m. news bulletin, we're going to have a breakfast grill. And I have to say, I'm particularly excited about this.
Why? Why, Shaoning?
Because it's a bit of nostalgia for me. And it's one of my favourite food groups.
That's right. Because I'll be speaking to Kevin Bessner. He's the global CEO of A&W Restaurants. Many of you, including yourself, Shaoning, you know, have many attachments to A&W. Its history, the smelly bear called Ruti that you hug during your birthday parties there. You admitted you did it before, Shaoning.
No, I've never hugged the bear, but I've eaten many, many corny dogs and have drunk many, many root beer floats.
But we asked the question whether those kind of products are still relevant in this day and age. And so I'll be speaking to him about his growth strategy for the franchise in Malaysia, in Asia Pacific and globally.
Interesting stuff. So do tune in to listen to this breakfast grill with the global CEO of A&W, Kevin Bessner. That's going to be happening after the 8 a.m. news bulletin. But in the meantime, let's turn our attention to particularly the events that's unfolding in Europe. Because on Friday, the president of the European Council, Charles Michel, announced that Ukraine and Moldova have been granted candidate status to the European Union, marking the first step of the process to become a full-fledged EU member. Ukraine applied for membership 5 days after the Russian invasion, while two other countries under the former Soviet ambit, Moldova and Georgia, submitted applications in March. Now, while Georgia wasn't given candidate status, the EU recognised its European perspective and could be considered once certain conditions were met.
The transition from candidate to member could take a long time, though. The three most recent joiners, Bulgaria, Croatia and Romania, took between 10 to 12 years. Now, back in 2016, the former president of the European Commission, Jean-Claude Juncker, estimated that it could take Ukraine 20 to 25 years to join the EU and NATO. So does the current conflict accelerate that timeline for Ukraine? And what are the implications for this expansion?
For a better understanding of the path to EU membership, we speak to Dr. Frederick Klim. He's a research fellow at the S. Rajaratnam School of International Studies. Good morning, Frederick. Now, help us understand, what is the decision to accept Ukraine as a candidate for EU membership? How important is this? Why is it so significant?
Hey, good morning, both. Great to be back on with you again. Hey, look, it's significant mostly for the signal it sends, right? I mean, it shows that the EU begins to see membership expansion primarily through a geopolitical lens. So the EU is quite often preoccupied with itself, right? But now it seems that it's no longer just about internal EU politics, about its perhaps absorption capacity, but it is geopolitical. It is about security and influence along the EU's borders. So the geopolitical objective here is to draw these countries into Europe, expand the EU sphere of influence, if you like. Because the alternative would be the risk that these countries in Eastern Europe and also in the Western Balkans, actually, will sort of exist in a vacuum, which might be filled, that is the fear in Europe, by Russia and possibly even China. And geopolitics is very much a zero-sum game. So nonetheless, at this stage, it's mostly symbolic. Candidate status is not much more than a political promise. And it is also true that the Ukraine membership candidate status would have not been granted if it was not for the war.
So what is the process to formally become a member then?
So the process is, I think it's best understood in like three stages, right? The first one is a country becomes a candidate, which has now happened to Ukraine, also to Moldova. But that doesn't necessarily mean anything, really, as I just said. It's more symbolic. But then candidates then at some unspecified time in the future begin formal membership negotiations. And that's a long process that involves adopting EU law, administrative reforms, economic, political reforms, and so forth to meet the accession criteria, right? Because as you might know, that the EU, unlike ASEAN, has very stringent formal accession criteria. And then once this process is completed and everybody's happy, then the country can join the EU. But it's important here to know that the second step, the membership negotiations, cannot start until all EU governments unanimously agree, right? 27 governments unanimously agree. And then once again, none of the negotiation chapters, of which there 30 to 35, I think, at the moment, can be closed until, once again, all governments unanimously agree, right? So you said in your moderation earlier in your bulletin that Jean-Claude Juncker kept saying what a long process this is. Mm. And I think he's right. Experience tells us that it is.
Okay. I want to know you about this implication of this EU enlargement to Russia. Now, you've basically said it's going to take a very long process. But this EU approach, how do you think Moscow will respond? Do you think then there's a potential for escalation from either side?
I don't think so. So as far as I'm aware, so far the response has been rather muted from Moscow. There have been a few statements, as far as I'm aware, that basically just say, look, this means that the West is further encroaching on Russia, that is, on our territory, our historic territory. And they, of course, view this as a problem. But to be honest, I don't think Russia would be too concerned at this stage with Ukraine joining the EU anytime soon. This, once again, both the ongoing war, of course, but also the long negotiation process makes this quite a remote prospect anyway. NATO would be a much bigger concern to Moscow, and they've always been very clear about this. And then we have now Sweden and Finland likely joining, right? So I think this is something Moscow is a lot more concerned about.
But I wonder whether other candidates like Turkey would be slighted with this membership for Ukraine, because Turkey has been applying for EU membership for some time, but progress has been relatively limited, there has it, for Turkey. And Turkey is a key ally both to Russia and to the EU.
Yeah, that's correct. I mean, I think I don't have an exact update on where the negotiation, or what the status is with Turkey right now. But for my understanding, it's out. Turkey is out of the window for now. And I don't think, especially under the current administration, it's going to go anywhere. Once again, you need unanimous decision in the EU, and you need to fulfill certain criteria. And Turkey is very far from it. I think much more likely are the West Balkans. And I think even in Turkey, I think most people have kind of accepted this, but in the West Balkans, actually, I think it's a bit more of a hot topic, right? Countries there have been candidates for decades, part of them, right? So some of them. So I think there is a much more discontent there. Should Ukraine, for example, or Moldova, for that matter, jump the queue here, as it were, right? Yeah.
So I'm curious, I mean, how is Ukraine going to actually meet the requirements for EU membership, right? Because there's this Copenhagen criteria. You need a functioning market economy, stable democracy, rule of law, acceptance of EU legislation, but they are at a state of war.
Yeah, correct. I mean, I think the challenges are significant, and this is why nobody expects them to join anytime soon. I think it will decade, perhaps more. Right, Ukraine simply does not fulfill the criteria, almost none of the criteria. Right, so this is going to take a very long time. The one thing about candidate status, which makes it slightly more than symbolic, perhaps somewhat contradicting what I said earlier, is that there are certain EU support mechanisms on which you could draw as a candidate. Right, which some of it is money. There's some funds available, not awfully much, but some. But there is also concrete support in terms of consultancy, capacity building, and so forth to meet those challenges. But nonetheless, this will be a very, very long process.
All right. Thank you for your...
I also want to highlight something that...
Hello?
Sorry. Sorry.
Sorry, please continue.
Yes. So, yeah, one thing that is often forgotten, that there is also a fundamental challenge on the other side, right, on the EU side. The EU needs to ask itself this fundamental question whether they want to initiate reforms of EU processes before they can further expand membership. I mean, some member states argue that, correctly in my view, that further expansion will harm the EU, right, its capacity to act. So we need reform on the EU side as well, not just on the Ukrainian side.
All right. Thank you for your time. There was Dr. Frederick Klim, research fellow at the S. Rajaratnam School of International Studies, giving us the lowdown in terms of anybody trying to be an EU member, or any country trying. And we know it's going to be a very long process.
It's a long process for the Ukrainian side. But, you know, Dr. Frederick Klim was very also clear that it also requires a bit of soul searching on the EU side. Because when you enlarge and expand, you end up being You can't really make decisions based on an enlarged bureaucracy, and you need to really rethink how you structure and make decisions going forward, because you're just including all these members, all of differing sides, all of differing scale and of differing levels of progress, right? It's going to be very difficult to make decisions and move forward as a collective going forward.
Imagine you need all 27 members of the EU to agree, even if you pass through this Copenhagen criteria.
Mm.
So I don't think it's an easy process, but of course
it
does give you some symbolic status. And like he says, Dr. Frederick Klein reminds us that it does come with a little bit of money. So maybe that's why, you know, people are like, okay, at least there is some status granted to us. It's the first step. But up next, we'll be speaking to Zohe Rosli on the impact of rising cost of goods. Stay tuned for that, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.